more involved than its Chinese counterpart in sponsoring cultural activities for ordinary people, but again, the similarities in broad outline quite marked. So you have two systems, about the same size, about the same lifespan, strong emphasis on political functions, political systems, bureaucracy and or law, and political symbolism, combined with the active encouragement of economic integration in ways that would make the system work. Differences, although differences within a context of still remarkable similarities. On the whole, and this has been suggested in an earlier comment, on the whole, I think it's fair to say that the Chinese regime, again, building on prior precedent, worked harder at integrating its vast territory than the Romans did. The Chinese planted larger colonies of people in frontier regions. It's absolutely vital to remember, as against our current impressions, that even the Middle Kingdom in China in the classical period was the scene of major ethnic mixing and ethnic division, to use a modern term, particularly in South China. The regime tackled this head-on by planting large colonies of northern Chinese in the south, as well as, of course, by encouraging the common use of Mandarin, at least at the elite and bureaucratic level. Some of these policies, by the way, are still being conducted in frontier regions by the Chinese regime today, so the continuity aspect is interesting as well as we look at efforts to integrate the western provinces and Tibet in contemporary China. Rome planted colonies also, colonies of soldiers, but colonies that could begin to develop a Roman lifestyle and Roman monuments in provinces as remote as England. But on the whole, these were smaller colonies. They didn't do as much, they weren't intended to do as much work by way of population integration, and they probably didn't accomplish much as much in this vein either. The Romans certainly encouraged the use of Latin by the upper class, although it never managed to erase predominance of Greek in upper-class circles in the eastern Mediterranean. The Romans certainly emphasized the expansion of Roman citizenship. Citizenship initially was confined to Romans themselves, then during the Republic was expanded as a possibility to certain people in other parts of Italy, and then under the Empire could expand to people who were not even remotely Italian. St. Paul, the great Christian saint, was extremely proud of the fact that he was a Roman citizen. So this was an integrating device, perhaps not totally dissimilar to spreading bureaucrats and language in Han China, but it didn't affect as many people, and the fact remains that Rome was content, not counterproductively in the period itself, Rome was content with a looser regime over most of its provinces, a reliance on considerable local autonomy, even existing kings where they were willing to follow Roman rules and provide loyalty and tribute, whereas the Chinese were more ruthless integrators in ways that may have helped produce a somewhat different subsequent history in the two societies. Both regimes conscious of integration for obvious reasons, but both involved in somewhat different specific procedures and specific results. Second interesting difference, although again, within a somewhat similar context, involves policies of expansion. Obviously, both the Roman Empire and Han China expanded a great deal, and this territorial expansion was one of the keys to their similarity, one of the keys to their needs to provide integrating devices, etc. But Han China was capable of surviving a cessation of expansion and was willing to operate in terms of more diplomatic interaction with borderline territories than the Romans proved interested in doing. So the Han Chinese obviously pushed the boundaries of empire out well beyond the Middle Kingdom, no question about this. But when they felt they had reached a sustainable term, they did not necessarily feel that they had therefore to compensate in some fashion for the cessation of expansion. Rather, they adopted a system of looking at potential neighbors like Vietnam and Korea in terms of payments of tribute rather than as candidates for further expansion. Rome's appetites, in this regard, seem to have been less clearly bounded. And I think there are a couple reasons for this. Arguably, although this certainly could be debated, the Mediterranean value system, not only Roman but Greek before, was quite simply more militaristic than the Chinese. Both societies depended on elaborate military commitments and devotion. I don't mean to oversimplify, but the importance of military valor probably played a greater role in the Roman definition of upper-class achievements compared to the greater Chinese emphasis on education and gentility, along potentially with military service. More practically and obviously still, the Romans, once the empire started particularly, the Romans needed additional territory as a means of rewarding generals and soldiers. They didn't have as clear a bureaucratic system in which successful generals could be rewarded without the addition of specific territories. And most obviously still, the Romans needed expansion in order to provide a continuing supply of slaves to a labor system where, in many agricultural estates and in the mines, as well as in domestic service, slaves were simply vital for production expansion, for successful operation of the economy. There were slaves in Han China. They were mostly domestic servants. They were relatively few in number. The economic system did not depend on additional slave supply, and in this sense, too, expansion could be halted without immediate consequence. Thus, now it's important to recognize both empires would decline. As we've already indicated, both declined after about the same period of time, so I don't want to overdo the Han advantage. But Rome more clearly began to suffer after the point, which was reached in 180 CE, after the point at which expansion became impossible and even a retreat began to be introduced. The system just didn't work as well in terms of supplying labor, supplying reward, supplying opportunities for the military itself to feed on victory rather than feed on domestic discontent and disruption of imperial selection and the imperial process itself. So, integration, a little bit different. Expansion, perhaps even more different. Interesting contrasts, again, within a remarkably similar context. Culture. Han China was, I think, unquestionably more culturally creative than Rome. Rome had its moments. Its literature, certainly its art and architecture, are splendid, but Roman cultural achievements tended to be more derivative from earlier Greek experience. This was a pattern that was established earlier in the Republic and on the whole continued in the empire. And it's less easy, with, again, some artistic and literary exceptions, it's less easy to point to basic Roman creativity in philosophic or scientific endeavor. Huge exception here once Christianity came in the later stages of empire, when Roman intellectuals, broadly construed, operated at extremely high levels. So again, we don't want to oversimplify. But the culture of Rome itself, the culture that the empire would itself emphasize, at least until the imperial conversion to Christianity, the culture was less robust, less creative, more derivative. It is perhaps worth reminding here that some historians have compared Rome's cultural position here to that of the United States, a very powerful society, strong in many respects, including military, but possessed of a cultural apparatus that was to some extent derivative from an earlier point of origin, Greek in the case of classical Rome, Western European in the case of the United States. Whether the analogy is useful or not, it's at least sort of fun to kick around. All right. Classical China was also, and we've discussed this before, more creative in the area of technologies, particularly production technologies. Classical China created, and this was prior to the Han Dynasty itself, but was something the dynasty was able actively to utilize. Classical China created basic philosophical and religious systems in a way that, with the obvious exception of Christianity, which was sort of a late adoption on the part of the Roman Empire did not. How much does this matter? How much did the ongoing creativity of Confucian and other intellectuals in Han China contribute to a measurably different result than in classical Rome. One point, however, returns us to similarity. Neither Han China nor classical Rome developed or sustained cultural systems on their own that satisfied what one might argue were the spiritual needs of important segments of the population. The Han Dynasty's emphasis on Confucianism, Taoism persisted, but the emphasis was on Confucianism. Classical Rome's emphasis on civic religion, the religion of the gods and goddesses, these emphases were interesting. They could help call attention to rituals and themes that would bring loyalty to the imperial system itself, but neither system was itself intensely spiritual, and both regimes in their later stages, and here's an interesting similarity, both regimes ended up seeing the importation of spiritual values from outside, or at least partially outside, the main imperial centers. In the case of Han China, Buddhism began to draw interest in the later stages of the dynasty and then would surge forward still further after the dynasty collapsed. In the case of classical Rome, the story is more familiar. Increasing numbers of Romans converted to Christianity by the 4th century, probably about 10% of the imperial population was Christian. And then in a hope to seize on a new method of winning popular loyalty and support, the imperial system itself embraced Christianity under Emperor Constantine, and the association of the final phases of the empire and Christianity became increasingly intertwined. Interesting development in both cases. Despite the differences in cultural creativity, both systems seemed to have something lacking that invited additional cultural innovation, additional cultural importation, at least things when things began to turn a bit bad. Both systems encouraged active military activity. The Roman system was particularly famous, and again, this was not a development that began with the empire, but was furthered by it. The Roman system depended on tight military discipline and the careful organization of infantry in the Roman legion. These legions were extremely effective. They were given substantial privilege. They developed tight bonds of comradeship, and they operated obviously very effectively through much of the early history of the empire. Chinese military was probably best known, at least in retrospect, not for its tactics, although these have to have been quite successful in many instances, but for its larger approach to military philosophy. So it's from the Han Dynasty that we get The Art of War by Sun Tzu, one of the great works on military thinking generated by any society anywhere, still utilized in military training in the present day. And one wonders here, and this is real speculation, one wonders here if there's an interesting contrast that would again go back to some of the other distinctions between the two systems. Rome was known for military force, military organization, excellent weaponry, and obviously for many centuries, great success. China was known for these things to a degree, but also for a level of thinking about the place of military activity in the larger political and social picture. So Sun Tzu was just as interested, perhaps even more interested, in writing about the limitations of the use of war, about writing about how war was a last resort and various other devices should be utilized in preference. And one wonders if, possibly in association with the different needs for imperial expansion, there's a distinction here that's worth remembering. The two empires obviously had different origins. The Han Dynasty sprung more directly from prior dynastic activity in classical China. It operated in a context in which a period of disorder under the Zhou Dynasty had been replaced by cultural Confucian as well as political emphasis on the importance of political order. The origins of the Roman Empire were a little bit more oblique. Obviously, the process of territorial expansion predated the advent of empire, But Rome's origins had more to do with, in politics, had more to do with the control of aristocratic landlords, the importance of a certain democratic element in Roman politics, and these were, on the whole, overridden by the institutions of the empire. To some extent, possibly, there's some difference in the smoothness of the advent of these two systems that would be worth attention as well. Most obviously, however, and this is the clear concluding point, and we will return to it two sessions hence, most obviously, the fates of the two empires continued the theme of a surprising amount of coincidence with an important level of difference. Both empires began to fade as the quality of individual emperors began to yield, as invasions from Central Asia or indirectly prodded by Central Asian migrations began to press into the territories of the empires themselves. Both empires suffered from increasing economic stagnation, which complicated not only material life, but also the taxation base of the empire. Both empires seem to have suffered from considerable inroads of disease that reduced population levels overall. So both empires, although at slightly different time periods, would fall victim to a somewhat similar process of decay and ultimate disappearance, at least in portions of its holdings. But in the case of the Roman Empire, at least in its western stronghold, in the case of the Roman Empire, the empire, once it fell, was gone, never to be revived as a whole. It would be remembered. It would be remembered with reverence. It would be selectively borrowed from by later regimes, but it was never reconstituted. The fate of the Han Dynasty was different. It, too, was destroyed. The Han never returned. But the key institutions and achievements of the Han Dynasty were revived by later regimes. So there's an interesting final difference between the two stories, a story of remembrance and selective utilization versus a story of revival because, among other things, it's been argued, the Chinese really, when they got their act back together following a period of disarray, the Chinese really couldn't think of a system that would do better than the Han had done. They could work to perfect it, and they did introduce some further changes, but they did not need to see its replacement because it really just needed to be restored. And Rome never quite achieved that final luster.
Lecture 8, The Silk Road, Classical Period Contacts.
This is a discussion about contacts among civilizations and regions during the Classical period. Of all the discussions we're having about the classical world, this one is perhaps the discussion that would most please the pure world historian, because as we discussed in the first session, world historians love to talk about contact. I probably need to worry about my credentials, because while I will talk about contact, and while I think that the contacts we'll discuss clearly have historical significance, I'm also going to rain on the parade a little bit to mention that the contacts not only occurred, but occurred amid severe limitations. So we're talking about two kinds of contacts involving several different patterns in each category. Contact first by means of trade. Contact first by means of direct juxtaposition between two civilizations. And we're talking about how these contacts need to be assessed in terms of the classical period itself and in terms of later legacies. Pretty obviously, the classical period rests primarily on integrations that occurred within large regions which we've come to call civilizations. In other words, the classical period is not defined by really local history, but by regional history and by patterns of connections that expanded those regions fairly systematically and in some cases very durably. But the contact that overlaid these regional integrations needs to be noted as well, while not overshadowing the regional picture itself. Regional focus remains primary. Contact is a significant overlay. Two major types of trade contacts developed during the classical period. The most famous one, and it's deservedly notorious, involved the contacts that went along what we've come to call the Silk Road, a nexus of trade routes that ran from Western China, usually through Central Asia across the northernmost reaches of the Himalayan mountains, into the Middle East through Persia, and sometimes beyond the Middle East on into the Mediterranean. Alternative routes would take some of this trade directly through India. The Silk Road is a nice label, but it is obviously important to recognize there was no single route, no nice highway markers. It's a pattern of Western Chinese to Middle Eastern to Mediterranean movement that we're focusing on here. The trade was romantic in many ways, at least as it has been recalled by historians and art historians. It took traders into a variety of ethnic settings, in Central Asia particularly. It involved frequently some direct interaction between merchants from established agricultural economies and nomadic traders. It's one of the ways in which the nomadic peoples of Central Asia played a direct role in world history through their contact, but also through their capacity to extend what people in the settled civilizations were interested in doing. It involved romantic designations in the along the way, such as the city of Samarkand, which I have never visited but would like to. It's a really interesting set of patterns. As the name implies, the good that was most important on this trade route was silk, manufactured in China, increasingly esteemed by people in the Middle East and even in the Mediterranean. By the time of the later Republic and particularly early Empire in Rome, it was fashionable for upper-class Romans, both men and women, to wear silk or silk adornments on their togas. This was obviously a prime luxury commodity. Flowing along the Silk Road also in the other direction were exotic animals, which the Romans were able to import from Africa, gold, slaves, a variety of goods that Westerners tried to use to match the important flow of manufactured products from China and, to a lesser extent, spices and food products from other points along the more easterly end of this chain. It's a terrific route to note. It's a favorite thing to ask about on world history tests, but we also need to ask what the significance was. Clearly, you can make a case that the Silk Road had at least a little bit of significance in terms of the economies and even more obviously the consumer patterns of some of the recipients of the trade. This is an example as we look at the increasing taste for silk. This is an example of the ways in which new patterns of world trade can feed new levels of consumer interest. The trade was undoubtedly economically important for some manufacturing centers in Western China and clearly important for the merchants involved. But I think it's fair to say that with these important significances noted, this is not a trade pattern that had deep significance for the economies of any of the major societies involved. It was an interesting addendum. It undoubtedly sustained some individual groups and peoples, but it wasn't an economic mainstay. Equally important, the trade proceeded in stages along the vast expanse of the Asian continent. Nobody, as far as we know, went the whole way. Romans were vaguely aware that China existed. They knew a lot about India, as we'll come to in a moment. They were vaguely aware that China existed. They tended to confuse it with silk itself and sometimes use the same word for both. We have no evidence, it's not impossible, but we have no evidence that anybody ever made it from the Mediterranean to China or vice versa. There's a possibility of a Chinese traveler, but no clear confirmation. The trade was in stages, which helps explain, along with the relatively light volume, why the Silk Road did not generate any particularly intense cultural exchanges or even technological exchanges. This is an interesting pattern of trade, not to be minimized, but also not to be exaggerated. A second nexus of trade, surprisingly robust, developed with India as its direct center. This involved trade from the Middle East and the Mediterranean, going directly to India, and also involved Chinese interest in direct trade with India. By the time of the Roman Empire, regular expeditions were mounted annually from the Red Sea to the subcontinent of India directly. Colonies of Roman merchants operated in some southern Indian cities. The key interest here was spices, such as pepper. But obviously, there was a sufficient trade to motivate some government encouragement. These were imperially organized expeditions. Some increased knowledge of the navigation patterns necessary to handle the wind routes on the Indian Ocean. And some direct involvement between the Mediterranean societies and Indian societies themselves. Chinese trade also reached India, not only overland along the Silk Roads, but through ocean-borne travel from the Pacific coast of China around to the Indian Ocean and to eastern India. At one point, for example, a Han emperor in China directly sent a ship to India seeking a rhinoceros for his personal zoo. So India is a second center of trade, and it reminds us again, as does the Silk Road, that classical civilizations did not operate in complete isolation from each other. They did increasingly learn the advantages of at least limited commercial outreach, and this outreach obviously tended to expand. There were some other trade routes that pressed beyond the boundaries of the classical civilizations themselves. As is pretty obvious from our earlier discussion of the patterns of Chinese tribute, China developed a fairly robust trade with places like Korea and Vietnam. India had probably the most extensive trade outreach of any of the societies. Our problem is the records here are not terribly elaborate. But Indian merchants, particularly from southern India, regularly traded with other parts of Southeast Asia, including present-day Indonesia. This is one of the reasons that pockets of Hinduism spread in these same directions, and this is another set of connections that's worthy of note. Mediterranean societies and Middle Eastern traders also developed contacts with certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa. We don't always know the specific means by which Romans, for example, acquired more exotic African animals, including lions, some of which were actually North African, but some of which were sub-Saharan. But clearly the Romans had means of contact with sub-Saharan peoples. Active trade connected Ethiopia in northeastern Africa with the Middle East and even points beyond in the eastern Mediterranean. It was through these trade contacts that Ethiopians acquired knowledge of Judaism, and some Ethiopian conversions to Judaism occurred before or during the classical period. And later, obviously, Ethiopian Christianity reflected the same kinds of well-established commercial and cultural connections with the Mediterranean world. Obviously, then, the classical civilizations, along with their strong emphasis on patterns of internal trade and internal commercial integration and specialization, reached out for certain kinds of products, for certain kinds of opportunities, to a wider network that embraced territories beyond the classical civilizations themselves and that could, to a limited degree, also connect these civilizations. Not surprisingly in this context, the classical period offers our first stories of great interregional travelers. Undoubtedly, such travelers had existed before. Remember, the human species was a migratory species. We just don't have records, and we don't know how far any given individual wandered. But in this period, among other things, the first great Greek traveler, Herodotus, the 5th century Greek, managed to write down his travel stories, and they reveal an active imagination.